after me, he says. The best creation. This is coming from the best of the creations. And he says, "Wal Hasan wal Hussein Sayyida Shababi Ahlil Jannah." We know this. That Hassan and Hussein are the Sayyids, the kings of the princes of Jannah. But what he says, "Wa abuhuma khayrum minhuma." What their father is better than them, he says. Now this is a pretty big honor. Now it clearly defines for us that even within the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, there is a hierarchy, you can say. That, of course, the first is the Prophet. You know, there's one rule that we always have to understand. And if we understand this rule, then our aqaid becomes easier. We find so many ahadith which describe the fadail of Imam Ali alayhi salam, saying he's the best at this, and the best at that, and the best at this. But he himself says, "Ana abdun min ibadir Rasul." I am a servant from the servants of Rasulullah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, 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 din al-Isl
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, I would like to ask you a very interesting question. There is a mother who has aborted her 7-month-old child, the illegitimately conceived fetus, at the request of the father, her father, the child's father. Should blood money be paid in this case? Assuming that it is a must to pay the blood money, who should pay it, first of all? All right. In other words, the mother or the father should pay the blood money. How much is the blood money nowadays, according to Ayatollah Khamenei? Would you enlighten us about this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I would like to say that no matter whether the child is legitimate or illegitimate by birth, a conceived fetus cannot be aborted at the request of anyone, be it the father or anyone else. It is haram to abort the fetus even if, for example, the child was conceived due to adultery, adultery is the biggest sin in itself, and it's the it's kind of unforgivable sin if the wife or the woman does not repent, because the woman is already married, and she has commits adultery with another man, so it's a grave sin, of course. But even then, the conceived child cannot be aborted. Now, the request of the father does not justify the action, and the woman should
raise the child.
Yeah, should raise the child.
Yes.
And if she, in the event that she has abortion and the fetus is terminated, the woman who is supposedly involved in the abortion should bear the blood money. And because she is responsible for the abortion, and of course when it comes to the amount of the blood money, and this is one of the frequently asked questions.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So you see, the amount of the blood money, you know, differs from stage to stage, and from one stage of pregnancy to another stage of pregnancy. Now, for example, if it is like a clot-like structure, this is one stage, and if it is like a flesh-like structure, this is another stage. Now, when it comes to the first one, the mother should give 40 dinars, 40 dinars,
mm-hmm.
Okay. And if it's the second stage, the mother should give 60 dinars, And the higher the stage, the more the blood money, In the event that, for example, it is in the stage of flesh without bones, of course, the mother should give 80 dinars, And of course, as I said in one of the previous episodes, the blood money should be paid to the inheritors of the fetus, to the heirs of their fetus, taking into consideration the classes of inheritors, because there are classes, there are categories or groups of heirs. For example, as long as the father is there, the inheritance cannot be given to the grandfather or to the grandchildren. So all those who are in the first level, as long as one person is alive, the inheritance or the blood money should be given to that person. And if there's no one in that first group, then the inheritance is given to the people in the second group, of course. So,
and if the father forces her actually to abort the child, then and who should pay? The father, obviously, right?
Yeah, coercion is one thing. Maybe the father, usually we see that the father sometimes, because of some reasons, whatever, yes, is worried about the child and does not want the wife to be pregnant
and the unwanted child.
Yes, yeah. So he might want the wife to get to terminate the pregnancy.
Yes.
That is not a valid reason for the wife to take action for abortion.
Mm.
And of course, as long as the wife can choose not to abort, if she ever takes action for abortion, then she is guilty. She is the one who is directly involved. Maybe there many other people might not want the child, because there are other family members. They do not want the child, that the mother to be pregnant. Okay, if for some reasons like this, the mother goes to the doctor and asks the doctor to abort the child, in that case, it is the doctor who is responsible, because generally speaking, it is the doctor who is directly involved in the abortion, because he he carries out the maybe a surgical operation, or maybe he gives a pill to the mother and tells her to take the pill. Now, the doctor can be involved directly. And of course, the parents, the mother and the father, they can forgive, they can forego, their rights, and they can exempt him of the blood money.
I see.
And they can choose to do all
okay,
of these actions.
Okay, I have a little interesting question that I would like to ask you, but after a short break.
Sure.
Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Joyed, our guest speaker in this program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about some of the Islamic laws around the subject of medical issues. I asked you a question before the break, Sheikh Joyed, regarding the blood money and the abortion of the unwanted child. In other words, illegitimately conceived fetus. All right? What if, that was my question I would like to ask you before the break, but unfortunately due to the shortage of time, I couldn't ask that before the break. So here it is. You know, if the father coerced or forced the mother to have an abortion of this fetus, then who should pay the money? The father? And then who should he pay the blood money to?
The blood money should be paid to the immediate heir, to the immediate inheritors. The closer the inheritors to the fetus,
yes,
the entitled they are, you know, the more entitled they are. I want to say that this is a very important point to
yes.
note. That the person who is involved, like for example, the father is involved in the abortion, or maybe the mother is involved, they are also the heirs, but they are not, they cannot receive
any money,
a portion from the blood money. Now maybe the mother gives the blood money to the mother. The mother gives the blood money to the father. The father was directly involved in the abortion. That father, who is a killer actually, is not entitled. Because the killing relative. Now, if, for example, in the actual world, if a son kills his father, the son cannot receive any share from the inheritance or from the wealth and property of his father. Because he has killed his father.
I see.
Okay? But his brothers and other relatives, other siblings, of course, they do receive. So, as I said, there are people in the first category, first group, and those are the ones, if they are not involved in the abortion, they are the ones who receive the blood money. The blood money is the inheritance. It is, because it's a kind of asset, it's a property belonging to the fetus. So that property should be divided according to Islamic Sharia among the heirs, okay, with the female child receiving half of the portion of the male child.
I see. And a very quick question here. You talked about the amount of the blood money, and you said that it is determined by the various stage where the fetus is,
sure.
right?
Yes.
So how much money is the blood money for deliberately aborting a fetus, for example, of a 2.5 months, and to whom it should pay? Of course, you said that the first degree inheritors, right?
Yes.
On condition that the parents are not the killers, for
yes,
example.
You're right.
So they don't receive any or inherit anything from the blood money. But what about deliberately aborting?
Sure.
And does it make a difference whether there is a soul or the presence? We are talking about the presence or absence of soul in the fetus?
Of course it does, you know. First of all, I would like to say that a 2-month-old fetus is not alive, because
there isn't any soul in there.
Yeah, there isn't soul in there. And of course, a child at the 4th month of pregnancy, a fetus in its 4th month of development, receives the soul, and actually it becomes alive. It turns to it turns into a living thing. Okay.
Yes. About so, 4 months.
Yeah, about 4 months. Yes. So, if now let's say that, because you just said that if the now if the abortion takes place deliberately, now if I just want to say that if it is a clot like structure, the amount of blood money is 40 dinars. This is 40 dinars. Yeah. And if it is a flesh-like structure, it becomes 60 dinars. But when the fetus enters into the stage of a bone, but without the flesh, the blood money is 80 dinars. The blood money should be paid to the inheritors of the fetus, taking into consideration the classes of the inheritors. And as I said, the father, if the father is involved in the abortion, he will not receive any share from the from the blood money. The blood money is the property, it is the inheritance, and it should be divided among the the legal heirs, with the male heir receiving double the share of the female heir.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chabit, for your nice answers. And thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Over 220 organizations have called on the U.S. government to ground F-35 fighter jet program. Campaigners believe that the program is a complete waste of taxpayer dollars that causes harm abroad and at home. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, prominent anti-war voices, including Media Benjamin, Noam Chomsky, Abby Martin, and Roger Waters, joined over 220 groups around the world in calling for the cancellation of Lockheed Martin's $1.7 trillion F-35 fighter plane program. The women-led peace group Code Pink is spearheading an international effort to urge Joe Biden and members of the U.S. Congress to cancel the manufacturing and training of the F-35 fighter jet, which has been docked by serious technical and operational problems since it first flew in 2006. I joined over 200 organizations from around the world in calling on the U.S. government to end the disastrous F-35 fighter jet program, because as a global community, we need to drastically change our priorities, Waters, co-founder of iconic Pink Floyd, said in a statement. He added, to the people in the countries the F-35 is sold to and produced in, it's time we demand a reinvestment into life, not war. In a letter to Biden and U.S. lawmakers signed by nearly 230 groups, Code Pink said its cancellation demand is based on the harm caused abroad, cost of the program to the taxpayer, inefficiencies and failures, the environmental impact of F-35s, and the effects training has on local communities. Some of those communities are in Vermont, where, despite railing against the military-industrial complex during his two presidential runs, Senator Bernie Sanders supports the F-35 program. Currently, F-35 training in Vermont disrupts the lives of working-class people, the letter states. The training is irregular, and Vermonters go without warning of when these trainings will take place. The noise caused by the F-35 hits 115 decibels, which especially hurts and injures infants and children, the elderly, and the disabled. The F-35 has 300 to 600 takeoffs and landings a month. Ben Cohen, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream and a Vermont resident, said that the global community is fed up with overpriced, underperforming weapon systems like the F-35. It's a complete waste of taxpayer dollars that causes harm abroad and at home in Vermont. The only people this project benefits are the executives at Lockheed Martin, Cohen added. Real security is knowing you can see a doctor when you're sick, not a boondoggle fighter jet that can fly near thunderstorms. That's just one of the many problems plaguing the F-35. The warplane's exorbitant cost has also raised critics' eyebrows and ire. According to the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, the F-35 price per unit, including ancillary costs like depot maintenance, ground support equipment, and spare parts, is $110.3 million per F-35A, $135.8 million per F-35B, and $117.3 million per F-35C. Those totals do not include the nearly $1.3 trillion in life cycle cost to operate and sustain the aircraft over its 66-year life cycle, making it the most expensive weapon systems in the U.S. history. Ashik Siddiq, a research analyst for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, recently noted that canceling all U.S. student loan debt would cost about $1.75 trillion, or about the same amount as the total cost of the F-35 program. Department of Education data shows that amount is also enough to eliminate all tuition at U.S. public colleges for more than 20 years. According to the Children Defend Fund, the projected cost of the program would also be enough to reduce child poverty in the United States of America by more than 60% for the next two decades. The F-35 program is a microcosm of the military-industrial complex. Each year, the U.S. government funnels massive amounts of money into the program while letting places in the U.S. go without clean water for the months or years, said Code Pink National Co-Director Donaka Katowicz, adding, sustaining this program for any longer will have detrimental effects on human life and the Earth. The website of Morningstar wrote, The latest new piece of U.S. military hardware is estimated to be costing around $1.7 trillion, although costs are likely to increase significantly, according to campaigners. Code Pink said, in a time of economic uncertainty, climate crisis, and the necessity for peace and stability for people and planet, over 220 organizations have joined together in an international campaign to end the United States F-35 program. As the intention of the U.S. is to sell the fighters across the globe, campaign organizations from the United States, Britain, Canada, Mexico, Paraguay, Germany, Spain, Kenya, and Switzerland have signed up in support of the campaign. Ruth Rode, a board member at the Arms Information Center in Germany, said, Germany is looking to buy the F-35 to carry U.S. nuclear weapons stationed here. Not only is this going to be a large, unnecessary financial burden, but also sustains the disastrous, indefensible threat of nuclear war on and from German soil. An International Day of Action is being planned for 2023 to stop Biden, including the spend for the F-35 program, in his next defense budget.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. According to the Holy Quran, all the people will be on the edge of hellfire. Yet, those who did evil deeds will enter it, and the righteous ones will pass by it. In other words, the hellfire will take some away with itself. So if you did good deeds in this world, you will not be absorbed by the hellfire. Thus, when we ask for Imam al-Hussein's mercy on the day of entrance, we mean that Allah saves us from the hellfire on the edge of which we are passing on the day of judgment. If Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam mediates for us on the day of judgment, then we can be taken to heaven instead of hellfire. Therefore, If we want to understand the language of the Quran, we have to first understand its wording. The term warid means entering in Farsi language, but it means to be on the verge of or on the edge of in the Quranic wording. Even the people of heaven will be on the edge of hellfire. However, because of the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they will reach paradise. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ranjbah. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian president also met with Palestinian factions. This is the first such visit by Hamas officials to the Syrian capital since the year 2012. Hamas said the movement will continue to build and develop solid relations with the Syrian Arab Republic, considering that this decision serves the nation and its just causes, with the cause of Palestine at its core. Yet the important question is, why the resumption of ties at this time? For starters, the resumption of relations between Hamas and Damascus would strengthen the axis of resistance in West Asia. Hamas will now cement its role within the axis of resistance against its enemy, Israel. This may impact the way each acts against the other, especially militarily. This reconciliation appears to have rattled the U.S. cage, which was quick to denounce the move. It said the Assad regime's outreach to this terrorist organization only reinforces its isolation. It also harms the interests of the Palestinian people. But Hamas's move formalizes a rapprochement that has been underway for some time and comes amid fundamental shifts in West Asia. For example, Turkey is considering a rapprochement with Assad. The UAE has already done the same. Also, Jordan's King Abdullah II has showed overtures. The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have gone ahead and reopened their embassies in Damascus. This is while senior officials in several Arab states are pressing to reinstate Syria's membership of the Arab League. Another important development has taken place that cannot go unnoticed. Palestinian factions signed a reconciliation agreement in Algeria, in which Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year. In the Algiers meeting, Ismail Haniyeh said, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." He thanked the Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune for his country's efforts in sponsoring the talks. But what did he mean exactly? How would this reconciliation enable Palestinians to see Al-Quds? Yet the timing of these two events, the Algiers reconciliation of Palestinian factions, then Hamas's trip to Syria, gives the impression that there are serious diplomatic moves being made between Palestinian factions. Another development, which is another piece to this puzzle, is the head of Hamas's political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, visiting Moscow recently and holding high-level political talks with Russian officials, including the foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. This puts the spotlight on Russia's role here. Russia is signaling how it wants to play a more constructive role when it comes to the West Asia region, especially when it comes to Palestinians. This couldn't be any clearer than the stance that the PA President Mahmoud Abbas took when it came to Russia, which was relayed during the SICA meeting that was held recently. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who met with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, relayed to him his mistrust of the U.S. in resolving the conflict with Israel, expressing an appreciation for Russia's role. He voiced his support for the Mideast quartet of international mediators, namely Russia, the U.S., the United Nations, and the European Union, but said the U.S. could not be left a free hand to act alone. He said, "We don't trust America, and you know our position. We don't trust it, we don't rely on it, and under no circumstances can we accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem." Maybe that is why the U.S. is raising the alarm over the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. Now that they are on one page, they can act with one voice against Israel and the U.S. And the U.S. reaction to this is very telling when it says that it will take this out against Palestinians, instead of taking a diplomatic approach towards the two groups reconciling, since they can speak with one voice for the Palestinians. This may mean that there will be more pressure and violations by Israel against the Palestinians with full U.S. support.
The Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Jacob, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But you're
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
You are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yami.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank. The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that seize Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the Commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the U.S.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign Ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed-136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
France is facing protests over the cost of living crisis fueled by soaring inflation. Police have clashed with the protesters, venting anger in the capital, Paris. Protesters were met with police brutality. Police used batons to disperse the protesters, who were throwing rocks at security forces. There are calls by trade unions for a nationwide transport strike. Unions now say it is time to expand the industrial action at oil refineries to other sectors. Protesters and strikers say they need pay rise to cope with the soaring cost of living. France is now experiencing inflation at 6.2%. That is the highest rate in decades. Striking workers are demanding higher wages from the profits of energy companies amid high oil and gas prices. Protesters have demanded emergency measures against high prices, including freezes in the cost of energy. The industrial action has taken offline more than 60% of France's refining capacity. Macron's government is also on the defensive in Parliament, where it has lost its majority in legislative elections in June. It is much more difficult for his centrist alliance to implement his agenda against strengthened opponents. France is not the only country in Europe that is facing protests. European countries are facing more strikes and protests due to high energy prices and the mounting cost of living. The UK economy shrank by 0.3% in August. It experienced a 10.2% inflation rate in September, which was the highest in 40 years. The latest data shows that inflation rose on average to 10.9% across the European Union. Europe faces a very difficult economic climate if the current energy crisis worsens, with winter temperatures likely to be a decisive factor.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim, Islamite. Allah my Lord, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet, praise be upon him. I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, you are listening my voice from Youth Station, and this is RRB English Radio. We are here to talk about something really interesting.
Inshallah.
And here with me, I have a dear co-host.
Assalamu alaikum.
Mahdi.
Thank you for remembering me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay.
Assalamu alaikum. My dear brother. So it's somehow the same old story of every time here, but I think it's still interesting to talk about the nature and nurture and the paradoxical content between these two.
I think you've got a medical background, so you're like just, you know, throwing out those words, you know, like, come on, man, speak English.
Okay, I'm sorry. It was that much annoying. So
you just mentioned a few words and I'm confused. So could you like tell me more about the definition,
okay, got
or whatever
it.
That you
said. You know what? Who you are is determined by many factors in this world.
Okay.
But two main factors
who
are...
Who I am is determined by many factors in the
exactly.
world.
Exactly. But the two most important factors are gene and the situation and environment you are growing in.
Okay. Okay.
And today...
in terms of what, my career...
Not only your career, but mostly your career, because somehow your career is your life. You know, your career is the way you live and the way you act, the way you think about professional things. And
okay.
I think career is something really important in life.
Yeah, it is an important part of your life, yes, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're saying that what you inherit in your blood, like your genes...
Yeah, something like that.
...is something that determines your... future in terms of course
no
future,
no
but like your
I
career?
Do not agree myself with that point of view. I think there is a combination of these two that will make you what you are, but
you?
You know, I mean, there is a balanced combination of gene and situation
okay.
that will determine what
you
are
in?
And who you are,
like, okay, yeah.
But I want to just know your mindset about this topic. Which one is more important?
More important, as far as we've seen. We've seen certain people who are physically fit, who are mentally fit, smart, were prodigies
mm-hmm.
in their times, and their children, right? The parents, both of them, father and mother,
are normal.
Were prodigies,
oh.
right? And the children came out to be plain dumb. You know what I'm saying?
Nice one. Yeah,
right?
I saw that.
There were numerous examples. So extracting from not just this one example, but numerous other examples, I'd say that whereas it is a very vital role that genes play in your life, but yeah, the environment, and once you've started observing the places around you, your environment, everything. After that, the way you were, where you were, whom you'd hang out with, how you were raised, how you were interacted with. Yeah, these things are something which have a major and greater role in developing your.
So you mean situation, environment is more important, or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. That's something.
You know what? I didn't like something about your speaking, and it was you were just looking at genes like something so easy, like it's about your parents, but it's not about your parents. It's about generations before you.
Right.
You know what? And you're going to just tell that, okay, because, for example, there were a dumb person that his parents were, for example, paralyzed or something.
Yeah, but like, so you mean like his granddad could be dumb and he's like his granddad.
There
now.
Could be. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just
right.
telling that.
See, see.
No. I'm not a supporter of the genes or something. I'm the supporter of this idea that there is a balanced combination of these two.
Right.
But this word balance doesn't mean equal. You know what? For example, there are differences even between me and you. For example, maybe you were 50-50, and I mean,